BCFM 93.2.
I told you that this was not any kind of a radio broadcast that you've ever heard or ever will hear anywhere else. You see, most radio personalities have a vested interest in maintaining their show on the air and going up the ladder career-wise and making a lot of money. None of those interests prevail here, I can assure you. Our interests are in saving freedom for the world.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summer and me, Tony Gosling. More evidence from the Turkish coup attempt that the Russians may have saved Erdogan's life. So, is Turkey really in NATO anymore? Also, whatever happened to the peace dividend? We get the views of the Brave New World author Aldous Huxley on a similar topic. He was talking back in the 1950s. And also, more up to date, former Iraq and Libya negotiator for the CIA, Susan Lindauer. Well, he was sent down for 14 years as a scapegoat for the multi-billion pound LIBOR fraud a year ago last week. Known as Rain Man because he didn't fit in with the coke-snorting city set, preferring KFC to the boozer at lunchtime, Tom Hayes was headhunted from Swiss UBS to Citigroup in London, where LIBOR fixing was organised and sanctioned by bank executives. But Tom picked up a lot of evidence along the way, even handling a leaflet on how to fix the LIBOR rate he was given at UBS by Carsten Kengeter, his boss. Now, Carsten is now in the process of taking over the London Stock Exchange. He's still walking free. We speak now to Tom's father, Nick Hayes. Hi, Nick, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Glad to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Could you tell us a bit about yourself, Nick, and, you know, what's your background?
Well, I'm retired now. I live in Manchester and spend most of the time digging my allotment, but before that, I was a journalist at the BBC, like yourself, actually, at some point, and I worked in current affairs, and I think I worked, actually, on most current affairs programmes that had ever been transmitted, at least since the early 2000s. So I was on the Money programme, Nationwide, Panorama. I helped to found Watchdog, and I was editor of Watchdog for 3 or 4 years. Then I moved to Manchester to work for Granada and World in Action. Then I went to Channel 4 News and worked on dispatches and you name it. So I've had a long career in current affairs TV.
Can you tell us a little bit about Tom then? I mean, he's been referred to, some would say, slightly unkindly as Rain Man, but whether you think, it's true that he didn't quite fit in to the usual type of hard-nosed city trader.
Yeah, it is true. I mean, he used to go... by repute, he went to the Christmas party and used to read a book. And he, as you say, he preferred KFCs to posh dinners and just used to wear normal sort of polo neck sweaters and look really quite scruffy, as he himself admitted. And he was later diagnosed, I think just before the trial started, as having Asperger's syndrome. It was diagnosed as mild Asperger's syndrome, although that diagnosis being mild is quite controversial. Yes, it means that he's, he's a very personable guy, and he's incredibly popular, and he's kept most of his old friends, even though he's been through the mill, and he's got incredible support from his family and all of his friends. So he's a very likable guy, but he's also very nerdy, so he's very single-minded about trading and watching prices on his computer. So if you say hello to him or you ask him a question, quite often you won't get a reply. He'll be just gazing at his computer and he'll say, what was that you said? And the problem with the Asperger's syndrome thing is the way you relate to people in authority. It gives you a lot of trust in people who are above you. And if they say, do something, you do it. And you're a stickler for the rules, actually, funnily enough, although Tom seems to be accused for breaking them. The rules were that the UBS wanted him to trade LIBOR products and to trade to the commercial interests of the bank. They told him that's what they did. They'd been doing it for years before he joined the bank, and he went along with it.
So when did you first realise that something was wrong? When did Tom realise?
Well, he got the sack, first of all, a week before his wedding in about August 2010, when someone at Citi had raised the issue of this LIBOR manipulation. But we thought that was the end of it, and it wasn't really till the end of 2012 when the political climate began to change, or at least heat up about bankers, and it became apparent that that Tom was in the frame as the LIBOR issue raised its head, particularly in Tokyo and particularly with UBS. And what happened was, first of all, was that UBS scuttled very quickly to try and cover its tracks. And the way they did that was basically to put my son in the firing line. So they trawled through all his emails and all the rest of it to show that he, as the picture they wanted to present of him, was some kind of devious ringmaster at the center of a web. That was far from the truth. Basically, what UBS were trying to do was to lay off the blame from themselves. So they sought immunity from prosecution from various authorities who were investigating, as in Canada and in America, so that they could spill the beans on Tom, so that they would escape with nothing more than actually quite paltry fines, given the financial strength of the bank. So it started from there, and then that fed into a very hostile political climate, both in America and in this country. And so that's how it started. So around about 2012, I think, we began to realise that things were very, very serious.
One of the bizarre things about this is that there was conspiracy charges here, and yet Tom seems to have been a lone conspirator all on his own.
Well, yes. The people that he was supposed to have conspired with were, in the main, six brokers with whom he worked as a trader at UBS and at Citi. They were accused, as he was, of conspiracy to defraud. The jury heard the evidence, and it took them less than 24 hours to chuck out the evidence after an incredibly complicated 10-week trial. The jury looked at it and said, this is a load of rubbish. These guys are just fool guys. They're ordinary South Londoners. I wouldn't call them, they were working-class origins, even if they weren't working-class at the time. And they were having none of it. That basically meant, for most common-sense-minded people, that the whole case against Tom fell apart because there was no conspiracy. There are other names on the list of he was charged with them and persons unknown. We don't know who those persons are. We know some of the other people, but none of those Tom traded with on LIBOR products, so he cannot have conspired with them. The point about a conspiracy is that you have to speak to the submitter. It's the submitter who submits the rates. Nobody else. Tom didn't do that. The brokers didn't do that. They didn't charge any submitters in this country, to my knowledge, not with in Tom's case. So wherein lies the conspiracy? I'll tell you, Tony, where the conspiracy lies. There is a conspiracy. It's nothing to do with Tom. It's a huge, big conspiracy on the part of the politicians, the regulators, the banks, all trying to stitch up a few low-grade traders, people like my son and the people at Barclays, who were doing the bidding of their bosses, who'd entered into a system which wasn't illegal at the time. Everybody was doing it. You may not like it. You may not think that trading to your commercial advantage is something to be desirable, but there was no law against it. In fact, there were no regulations about it. There was no training in it, particularly for Tom, because he was in Tokyo. He worked for a Japanese bank, a foreign bank, trading in a foreign currency. Nobody in this country was affected. Nobody lost any money. Nobody complained. Yet the politicians wanted a head on a plate. And unfortunately, my son was first in the firing line.
What about being handed a guide on how to fix the LIBOR rate as part of your job when he was at UBS? Does sound like Tom is just basically that this is part of his job description. He's being told to do this by his boss, absolutely, who at the time was this guy, Carsten Kengeter, who's now the head of the German Stock Exchange.
Well, I mean, Tom was present at meetings with Carsten Kengeter when the whole LIBOR thing was discussed. I mean, I don't know the detail of that, so I can't really say more about Carsten Kengeter, but I do know that Tom's bosses were deeply embroiled in the whole LIBOR thing because that was the bank's policy. It's there in black and white. You only have to look at some of the evidence in the trial, look at what's been was said by the British Bankers Association, look at what other people working in the industry said. It was well known that UBS and other banks traded products to their commercial advantage. And why shouldn't they? Because nobody said it was illegal, nobody said it was wrong, and nobody, not even the Bank of England, nor not even the Bank the British Bankers Association, the trade body which regulates this, tried to stop them. They changed the law in 2012 where they did make trying to influence LIBOR rates a crime as part of the Financial Services Bill. They gave it a 7-year sentence maximum. So it's a 7-year sentence now, which compares with the 14 years, double that Tom originally got from Judge Cook.
So what's your personal experience of the whole court process? I imagine you've been to court a fair bit to see this trial.
Well, I didn't go a lot to the original trial, being in Manchester, and because Tom had a lot of support down there, and there was not always the seats. But I went to the appeal court, and I've stayed with the case an awful lot. I tended to become more involved with it after the verdict and the conviction, because I suppose I was hopeful that nobody in their right mind would convict him on the evidence that there was. But having said that, the evidence, an awful lot of really crucial evidence, was denied by the judge to the jury so that they couldn't make a proper judgment about it. They couldn't, for example, hear evidence about his Asperger's condition and the way that may have led him to behave when he was a trader. They didn't hear evidence about his profit and loss account, which would have enabled Tom to refute a lot of the allegations by the prosecution about how much money he was making from his trades and what the value of them were. They didn't hear evidence about other traders at UBS who'd been investigated by other regulatory bodies, notably the Financial Conduct Authority, a trader called Pete the Greek, who was at UBS, who was a senior to Tom, and also sat on the important regulatory committee of the BBA on LIBOR. He was accused of manipulating LIBOR. The FCA looked at it and they said they exonerated him, saying that there was no lack of integrity in what he did. So you've got one regulator letting a whole lot of people off the hook, and the serious fraud office and their pals going for Tom, as they did. Even though I can add, actually, that their senior legal advisor in 2011 gave advice to the Serious Fraud Office that there was no criminality involved in what they did. So David Green, who was new to the SFO, was there to rescue its appalling reputation, scuttled off to his old friend Muckle Chowler, the prosecutor, and brought him in to look at it again. And he came up with the conspiracy to defraud charge, which is what's known as a prosecutor's friend, because basically you can stick anything on anybody with it.
I understand also that there is some kind of database which LIBOR, people who were fixing the LIBOR rate, were using, which again wasn't allowed to be presented in court. Can you tell us, because that sounds to me like it may be some really crucial evidence that the traders are being told what to do effectively by their bosses, and really that they're just doing this. I mean, this is the thing that bothers me so much about this, Nick, is that you've got people who are coming in doing a job. It's part of their job description. They've got to do what they're told or they'll get the sack, and it just so happens that what they're doing is then sent to jail for.
Yes. Well, you raise a really important question, actually, Tony, because not only was evidence denied to the jury, but also a lot of new evidence has come in since the trial, which lies behind Tom's attempt to get his case reviewed by the Criminal Cases Review Commission and go back to appeal. And one of those is the existence of a thing called a spreadsheet. And I can hear people's eyes glazing over when they hear the word spreadsheet. But Tom had argued in his trial that UBS traders were required to input their recommended LIBOR rates into this spreadsheet in all the other currencies except for yen LIBOR, and that spreadsheet was then sent to the submitters in Zurich to act upon. This was poo-hooed by the prosecution and by the judge. They denied the existence of this spreadsheet. Tom didn't use the spreadsheet system because, being in Tokyo, they didn't have the software system to do it. That's why he always put his LIBOR recommendations and views in emails and in Bloomberg chats and the rest of it, because that's the way he could communicate his views. So unlike the others, he left a huge paper trail which pointed directly to him and which UBS were able to seize upon in order to blame him. Now, this spreadsheet came about as a result of another case, I think, before the Financial Conduct Authority. I'm not exactly sure of my facts here, but I think it was there. And this other trader argued and was able to demonstrate the existence and produce this spreadsheet. So he's able to show that UBS systematically was moving LIBOR in its own commercial interests across the piece, across all currencies, and had been doing so for years, doing so when Tom was still a schoolboy, going back to the 90s. So when Tom started to work for UBS in Tokyo, he walked into a pre-existing system. The idea that he sort of sat down and thought up this incredible scheme to rip people off was just a nonsense. And the irony is, actually, he was a very loyal trader, and UBS repaid him with no loyalty whatsoever. But he was a stickler for the rules. Things like insider trading, when he did his compliance trading here in London, the things that he was told not to do, he didn't trade on his own account. He could have made a fortune trading for himself at the same time as being working for his bank. He wouldn't do it on principle. That's one of the things about Asperger's, is you obey the rules. And some rules lead you to stay within the straight and narrow. Other rules you obey lead you into prison, whether you're expecting it or not.
What about the whole appeal process? How's that going?
He had an appeal in at the end of December. This appeal, actually, given that, let's go back, in August he was convicted a year ago, he appealed, and that appeal was heard in early December, at the same time as the brokers that we mentioned, the people he was accused of conspiring with, their trial was going through. That appeal was expedited, which is very unusual in the law, so that his appeal was heard before the brokers' case had come to an end. So he wasn't able to argue in his appeal that the brokers had been acquitted and the whole conspiracy case was in tatters, because that appeal was heard and he lost on most of the significant points. So he's got one throw of the dice left in legal terms, which is the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which I know a little bit about because, having been on World in Action when the Birmingham Six were released, if you remember, World in Action producers had played a key part in the campaign to release the Birmingham Six on the basis of being falsely convicted, and that led partly, that's in the Guildford Four cases, to the establishment of the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which was set up to look again at other cases in the event that there was new evidence or new legal arguments that could be adduced. So Tom is raising money, or his family are raising money now, to fund a campaign, because he didn't get legal aid to go to the CCRC. So I put a bit of money in this week to help him out. And if anybody else wants to help him out, they need to go to fundraiser.com, fundraiser.com. And then you can key in his name where it says search for campaigns.
And we'll certainly put a link in on our show page, thisweek.org.uk, to that. But look, you're a journalist, a retired journalist. And what do you make of the way that this whole thing's been reported?
It's been mixed. Some of the reporting's been has been pretty fair, from, for example, from the Wall Street Journal. others been appalling, actually, where, I mean, for example, the Financial Times is not very popular in our household because they were amongst the first to paint this portrait of Tom as the ringmaster at the centre of a spider's web. And but actually, subsequently, and I was quite surprised, on after he was convicted a year ago, I expected an outpouring of, last one of these horrible bankers has gone to jail, about time too, they should lock him up and throw away the key. That was not the general reaction. A few people thought that, but most people actually thought, rightly, that Tom was a scapegoat. And the Daily Mirror ran a poll over several weeks, actually, asking, was Tom a scapegoat or was he the ringmaster? Well over 60% of people thought that he was the scapegoat, and that's been the pattern ever since. I think most people have thought that, which is why people have actually helped with his fund for this, for the for a new appeal, because they recognise a huge injustice has been done, and they recognise that the people, the real architects of the financial mess that we're in, have all escaped any real attention or prison at all.
What about more sort of down-to-earth family stuff? Because I know Tom has married, he was, I think when I first came across this, his girlfriend, Sarah, and also how it's affected you.
Well, it's affected us all pretty badly, but we're quite a resilient lot, and we're quite fighters. Sarah herself is a lawyer and has got a very good legal brain, and she's stuck resolutely. I'm so proud of her that she's stuck with Tom, and they've kept their family together in the most appalling, difficult circumstances, because not only did she have to fight, help him fight the case, she's had to fight confiscation orders where the Serious Fraud Office were out to totally bankrupt the family and take all every penny that they had. Fortunately, they didn't do quite as well as they expected. And for me, well, I've sort of, it's strange actually, because I've sort of, having abandoned journalism, I've given it up, I've sort of quasi gone back to the journalistic world, talking to people like yourself and others, and writing things and tweeting things and talking to the press. So it's strange actually, but I suppose if Sarah's got legal skills, I've got a modicum of media skills. And we're applying those to try and help Tom as best we can.
I mean, I would have thought that back in the early 1990s, when you were at World in Action, that actually in those days there were a whole sheaf of different investigative TV programs, radio programs that would have looked into this, and this would be a much bigger scandal than it is. I wonder what you make of the sort of, I suppose, the slow death of investigative journalism and those really well-resourced programs like you were working on.
Yeah, well, a very good example of that, actually. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. Most of the programs that that existed and championed investigative journalism, a lot of them have gone. A lot of them struggle, like Panorama and Dispatches, who do a pretty good job, although it's very intermittent. They have to sort of bow towards doing consumer journalism and other stuff. So there's not really the dedication and the time and the money spent on really long-term investigations, and which is a great pity. I mean, I happen to know, I think journalists, TV journalists, have been looking at the whole libel thing, and I think they've got stuff, but the problem is they've been inhibited by the continuing court actions, which make it difficult. And that's a genuine problem that would have existed for us just as much as it does for them. Although I think we were more robust with our lawyers than happens these days.
I certainly agree with you there. So there's a few wet lawyers out, I'm afraid, in a lot of particularly in broadcast journalism. But look, what outcome would you like to see now, Nick?
Well, I'd like to see Tom out of jail and back with his family. The trouble is that the wheels of the law grind so slowly, it's very frustrating. I would like the Criminal Cases Review Commission to take up his case as speedily as possible, and I know it's being prepared very quickly, helped by generous people, actually, on the fundraiser.com thing that I was mentioning. And also, there has been interest in Parliament. There's a peer who's taken a great interest called Lord James, and he spoke in the House of Lords not so long ago about the case, and I think he's trying to bring the attention to the whole thing to some senior law lords, and I'm not sure whether there's some kind of fast-track way to short-circuit this injustice. I wish there was, I'm not optimistic.
And, look, I'm going to leave the sort of biggest question till last, actually, because that is the thing that's been in my mind almost all the way through this, is that Tom has got a massive amount of evidence on senior bank executives that he worked with who knew that libel fixing was going on, actually, that were his bosses and were instructing him to do this libel fixing. So the obvious thing in this kind of case would be for Tom to turn Queen's evidence and to hand over all that information, and the Metropolitan Police or whoever to slap him on the back saying, thank you very much, now we'll clap these people in irons and put them on trial, the people that Tom has got the evidence on, the real big blue blood bankers.
Well, the problem is, Tony, is that a lot of them are not in this country, and they're hard to find or hard to prosecute. They're in Switzerland, or they're in Australia, and he's dependent upon the people like the SFO. Muckle Chowler said at the end of Tom's case that Tom may be the first, but he's not the last. We've seen no implying that that they were going to be the long arm of the law, would be reaching out to get some of these people. We've seen no evidence of that whatsoever. Tom has named some of the people. They're not household names, a lot of them. His immediate bosses and the people who worked in UBS are not names that we all know. But there's been no effort to interview some of the key players in all this by the authorities. And that applies both to the SFO here and the Department of Justice in America. It's not an optimistic picture. I mean, how many senior bankers who were responsible for the real financial crisis? I mean, the one in 2008, which is all to do with the mortgage securities in America and all the dodgy products and things which were marketed by illustrious names like Goldman Sachs and the rest of it. How many of those have actually been prosecuted or even been examined? Some of them have paid a few fines, there's been no attempt by the authorities to get to the key players. That's why they liked Tom, because nobody cared about him. He was just a small-time trader in Tokyo who gave a damn about him one way or the other. So they could look as if they could be being proactive and fighting for the consumer and champion of the citizens against the wicked banks. And who do they get? Tom Hayes in Tokyo, a minor player who was not even a banker. He was a trader. He's nothing to do with banking as such. UBS happens to be a bank who employed him, but he wasn't a banker.
Martin, what do you make of the fact, it seems here, absolutely proved beyond any shadow of a doubt that the blue blood bankers have got a get out of jail free card? They can do what they want.
Well, it's a very sad story. I've been listening to everything that's been said, and it must be very hard for you all. But I think that you're probably right, that you've just got to keep banging on about this, because eventually the public opinion, as you said, the Mirror, 60% of people think that he's been scapegoated. I think you've just got to keep working with that. The Birmingham 6 and the Guildford 4 had to spend many years in prison before they eventually got justice. And I suppose justice for your boy will be part of getting justice against the people who've messed everything up in the way that you've described. Because ultimately there is going to be a further crash. I'm pretty confident of that. And then the pitchforks and the guillotine really are going to come out.
And what do you make of this impunity? I mean, these people are still walking the streets. Some of them, like Carsten Kengeter, a multimillionaire who's just about to take over the London Stock Exchange.
Well, what I would say about that is that we've got problems with fiscal problems with countries all over the world running big deficits because of the crisis. And all of these people are incredibly wealthy. And if you bang them up and take their assets, that would go a long way to solving the fiscal problems that the governments have.
I think you've just come up with a new policy. Nick Hayes, son of Tom Hayes, who was jailed now. I think it's on appeal only for 11 years, but it's still a hell of a long time.
He's done 20% of the time he'll be in jail, he told me yesterday. So So that sounded a lot, and then you remembered 80% he's got to go for the rest of it. So.
Can you just wind up by just plugging your funding site, and also let us know how people can follow Tom's case?
Yeah, there's two things. On the funding, there's a fundraising site called fundraiser.com, and that's fundraiser.com. And I think you can put /UK, but I think you'd find it anyway. And then on the top right of that page, it says search for campaigns, and you put Tom Hayes in, and it'll come in.
We'll put a link into that, by the way.
And it'll show you how to contribute. And if you want to follow what's happening with Tom, the best way is through something called the Tom Hayes Support Group, which we've set up, which is both on Twitter and I think that's at Hayes Libor. I think it's is the Twitter tag.
Well, we'll put a link into that one too,
and on Facebook as well. So there's a Facebook page as well, the Tom Hayes Support Group, and that gives regular updates about what's happening and what's going on, because it's not just Tom's case. There's the Barclays case, and I think a number of the families are getting together now to try and fight for their fight for the people who got involved. It's not just Tom.
Nick Hayes, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Yeah, thank you, Tony, for having me. Much appreciated.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Well, I'm also joined in the studio by Kevin Carhill, journalist from the Sunday Times Rich List and author of Who Owns Britain. Kevin, what do you make of this case? Because it does seem, I feel almost like someone like Paul Foote here, looking at a massive injustice here, where somebody is scapegoated, put in jail for 11 years. Actually, what you should really be doing is getting some of those blue blood bankers and giving them a knock on the door, banging down their front doors at 3 a.m. and making sure they pay the price for the massive amount of money they've made out of the LIBOR fraud.
Yeah, I mean, you yourself have said most of it. Not a single banker who wrecked the economy has been tried or put in jail. Nobody. So a trader in Tokyo is a sacrificial victim, and we, the public, are meant to say, oh great, they've done something. They've done this. The establishment and the system have done nothing. They have, as to quote you, they've given get out of jails free cards to the people who wrecked most of the Western economy and left with their pockets full of money.
Also, this week we've had a UBS trader who's I think he's just got out of jail, Kweku Adeboli, saying that the bank's still at risk of huge fraud. So there's a complete and utter failure in any kind of regulation, remembering that the Financial Services Authority is actually funded by the banks. So they're basically doing their own regulation, and they're just playing around. They're doing whatever they want.
There is no regulation. It's a complete, the whole thing is a scam. And whenever something goes wrong, the banks thieve from their ordinary customers by way of jacked up charges and everything. So they fill their boots again and walk off.
The latest ruse, Martin, is this negative interest rates, low interest rates, where they're now saying I'll tell you what, we're going to be taking money out of your account. We won't be paying interest anymore. Now, that has massive implications for all sorts of legacies which have been left for hundreds of years to maintain, for example, churches, this kind of thing, and also it means that they want to get rid of cash, because otherwise we will just keep cash, because our cash won't be going down in value like our bank accounts will.
Well, it's a sign of desperation, isn't it? That's what it is. Who would have predicted 20 years ago that you would have had zero and negative interest rates?
What's at the root of
capitalist financial market?
What's at the root of the problem here?
Well, the root of the problem is that they haven't resolved the problem. So that's why we're going back to quantitative easing and reducing interest rates in this country.
It feels to me a bit like a feudal system where the various dukes, where the sheriff of Nottingham or whatever is one giant bank and somebody else. It does seem like it, very medieval.
Well, it's been very profitable. QE and negative interest rates have been very profitable for some people. It's not actually very profitable for the business model of the banks. So there's a danger that they will be pushed over the edge here. Incidentally, Kevin, I do believe that three Irish bankers were sensed.
Yeah,
were sent down last week, weren't they? I can't remember.
They were. They're the first people who were involved in the actual, you know, thievery and fraud. But what about? I mean, this is what 8 years later here in the United Kingdom, where nobody at all has even been charged.
Well, one of the
Ireland has charged more, and the other country that went after the bad bankers was Iceland. Mm. They put lots of their bankers in jail.
Let's just look at this story Martin's pointing out there from Ireland. Dishonest, deceitful and corrupt Ireland jails three top bankers over the 2008 financial meltdown. That's taken a long, long time. Three senior Irish bankers were jailed last Friday for up to 3.5 years for conspiring to defraud investors in the most prominent prosecution arising from the 2008 banking crisis that crippled the country's economy. The trio will be among the first senior bankers globally to be jailed for their role in the collapse of the bank during the crisis. The lack of convictions until now has angered Irish taxpayers. So I'm just trying to find their name. The names of these guys, I mean, you've probably never heard of them. Dennis Casey is one, Minnie Willie Makita, and John Bowe. But this, I mean, actually, if you add up those sentences together, Kevin, they don't even come to what Tom Hayes is having to serve.
No. They weren't top bankers. That's a tabloid headline. They were senior in the system, senior enough to fiddle the accounts. It's amazing what they were doing. They were taking money from a building society, putting it in the bank's books for a day, the day of the audit. And then the money went back to the building society, the bank having been made to look, it was Anglo-Irish Bank, made to look sound. But the failures in Ireland were the banking regulator, the head guy.
Surely the auditors should be picking that up. What are the auditors doing? What are they paid for?
The only mag that's after the auditors consistently is Private Eye. You know, one catastrophe after another, and one of the ones right up at the top at the moment is BHS. The day, quite literally, the day before Green sold BHS to the bankrupt chap, it was signed off by one of the big auditing companies. How?
Well, it's because the auditing companies are fraudsters. They're basically banks. I can remember reading, this is in David Southwell's wonderful Secrets and Lies book, which I want to get you a copy of it, Kevin, I think. It's one of those, it's sort of the greatest book that anyone could ever have on their coffee table. It's got everything in there. And I think actually this was a reference to, yeah, this is to do with Charlie Richardson, the South London gangster who was rife. In the 1960s and 1970s, well, finally the Wilson government had him arrested, or the police did, or the Wilson government forced, or whoever the Home Secretary was, to finally get him arrested and put him in jail. When he came out of jail, he walked straight into a job in the City of London. And this is the guy who'd been snapping people's toes off with bolt cutters and throwing electric fires into the bath with the people he wanted to intimidate.
Electric fires in the bath is usually fatal.
Quite often, yeah.
You don't often get out of a bath that has electric fire.
Martin, it does indicate the sort of people that have been being employed in the city, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think the other thing that people need to realise is there's an academic in the US called Philip Murovsky, and he's been analysing what's been happening since the crisis. And in actual fact, the bailout of the banking system and the quantitative easing and all the rest of it has actually made the top bankers richer than ever. So they've actually benefited from the crisis.
So they've used the resources
that they've managed to gain from the crisis to bribe the political system. So, you know, Obama will, like all other
US
presidents...
So how have they been doing that in the Labour Party then? Come on.
Well, the fact is that money talks and money swears. I mean, Foster, that's just been suing the Labour Party because he wasn't happy with the NEC's decision to have a ballot about Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. He was apparently a major donor to the Labour Party. I've never heard of him. But he's, and these people are now suing the Labour Party because it's not doing what they want.
And then he failed.
Yeah,
yes, he did.
But, I mean,
point is that these people are very powerful. The bailout of them out of the banking system has allowed them to have even more power than they had before, and they've used the financial power that they've been given in order to buy the political system.
Now, Kevin, you've been in this business a long time. I wonder if, are we being a little bit paranoid in saying that things are getting worse and worse? Because surely at some point in the past, fraudsters used to have their collars felt, didn't they? Didn't they sometimes go to jail?
We are living in an era of near absolute immunity for bankers. Back in, say, 30 years ago, as you say, quite frequently, if the fraud became too blatant, colours were felt. That stopped altogether. And the fraud has become beyond blatant. I mean, it wrecked the economy. I mean, what more do you want to do before you start going around and putting people on trial?
Was there ever a time, do you think, that the financial system worked for ordinary people?
Never.
Where actually the system was there to facilitate the flow of goods and services? Because it does seem to me now that the system is being used to sort of reward criminals and punish people who are honest brokers, honest dealers.
I think the last time the system worked for the small guy was around about the time of the East India Company, and not since. The little man, the little woman have now been wiped out of the system, and more dangerously, there's no way they can get redress. The agents of the state, who are supposed to feel the colours of the bad guys, have walked away. This, I don't know if I've raised it before, but before Christmas, I got quite an interesting judgment from the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. I went in and said, you know, intercepting emails is a criminal offence, sir. And who said that? Sir Anthony May, QC, the Information Commissioner. And the tribunal actually listened to me. And I said, no, I'm not going to get anything out of this. But towards the end, they recessed for a minute. And then the Prezi chap came out and said, well, look, is it okay if we send your evidence to the police? That's what I'd asked him to do. I'd asked them to actually order an investigation. He couldn't do that. But they said, fine, but can we send your evidence of this criminality to the police? So I said, yeah, great, because that was more than half a loaf. So they sent the evidence to Bernard Hogan Howe. And Mr. Hogan Howe, who also should be stripped of his knighthood, wrote me, I've got the letter, I'm keeping it. It's personally signed. And it said, no, I'm not going to investigate this criminality. I mean, how more black and white can you get? Well, he said, no.
There's another type of criminality out there, and that's called Conservative election fraud. Something like 17 forces across the country are supposed to be looking into the fraud, the financial fraud, our local election is Thornbury and Yate, where it looks like there was an overspend and the Conservatives won. But Martin, you know, there does seem to be a kind of almost like an epidemic of criminality, which is in the police are just not looking into.
Well, it's what the activists in Latin America call impunidad, impunity. So you can be, repression can happen in such a way that you are the target of the state. You know, you're disappeared, assassinated, imprisoned. And then there's another way in which you can be, you basically, people get away with doing what they're doing, and they're not held to account. And that's a way of taking people's rights as well. I think that the one positive thing I can say about this is that they are criminal. They are criminal. When we say that the people are criminals, we're not using political rhetoric. We're using an absolutely, you know, that's exactly what they are. And what you could imagine happening, if we can get a head of steam up, is once you start taking down one or two of these big guys and sending them down, you can then say to them, right, we want more information from you, and you'll be treated leniently.
Yeah, but
and then you can perhaps get the rest of them.
It goes, I mean, our new police commissioner in Devon and Cornwall is under investigation for the electoral fraud. So how are you going to get... And she, when Hogan Howe said no, the other person, the other party that the judges sent the evidence to was Devon and Cornwall. And she has, you know, well, guess what? No, no, it's not part of her child protection policy, and she can't order the police to do anything, and no, she's not going to do anything either.
Well, the big irony here is that we had, in the first police and crime commissioner elections here in Avon and Somerset, there was a Labour candidate who was told he couldn't stand to be a police and crime commissioner because of a caution by the police for crossing the railway when he wasn't supposed to have crossed the railway when he was a teenager.
Yep.
And yet somebody is running the system in Devon and Cornwall who it looks like may be implicated in election fraud. Yep. Right now.
So, you know, I mean, where do you get?
And look, it seems like a complete breakdown, Martin, in any kind of law enforcement.
Well, let's put it this way. Because there is no rule of law doesn't mean that there shouldn't be.
Let's focus it very narrowly. I have a very good understanding of the system and everything. I'm not a lawyer, but I am able to get myself before the High Court. You know, I know how to do it. And what I discovered is I was trying to get a prosecution against the parties who intercepted my emails, who have been proved in a court of law to have done it. And I discovered, could I go in my local court? No chance. The nearest I could get to having anything done was the High Court. Well, a normal human being, it's going to cost them 20 grand to get into the High Court. And then it's a casino. God knows how I got the judgment. I think the judges were scared. they were scared because guess why? It wasn't so much my emails being intercepted that I was, you know, creating about. A couple of children of my acquaintance had two things. They had their emails intercepted. That's criminal in the United Kingdom. Children, remember who I said and named, Bernard Hogan, how refused. And the second thing was they've had their data nicked.
Anyway, the Queen has just got a 6.5% pay rise, Kevin. And one of the things that does bother me about this is that she's a kind of, when any kind of criminal prosecution is happening in Britain, to connect up with what we were just saying, it's the Crown that does that prosecuting. But she's got a 6.5% pay rise and will net a cool 45.6 million from the taxpayer next year. Now, I know you've done quite a lot of research into her wealth, because she's a massive landowner and she's getting a massive income from her land. So why does she need 45.6 million pounds from us?
Well, the answer is, you know, she's got this, this is the official answer, that she's got all these people to pay, you know, private secretaries and doorkeepers and you know what. And it's very expensive being the head of state. Well, has anyone ever noticed that there's something our head of state doesn't do? She doesn't make a declaration of her interests. And I think that's the Republican society, you know, the Cromwell's last descendants, are busy trying to do things.
Well, they've blocked the Crown from having to respond to freedom of information requests as well.
Yeah, the Crown are protected. But this is the head of state. You know, there's no other country where you can be head of state, make no declaration. Well, there are Kazakhstan and Turkey and a few other odd places. But in the United Kingdom, a democracy, the head of state makes no declaration of her personal interests.
What about the Crown estate? It's massive, isn't it?
14 billion to you, sir. This was, for the first 7 years of the rich list, the Queen was always at the top because of the Crown estate. And of course, the palace eventually phoned Murdoch and told him that this was, you know, bringing the rich list into disrepute. It was actually doing the rich list a world of good. But the bottom line was, they said she didn't own the Crown estate, because my valuation was based on that. In 2010, almost the first act of the coalition government was to declare that she was the owner of the Crown estate. So she's worth a minimum of 14 billion.
She certainly doesn't deserve any taxpayers' money, as far as I can see. Now, Martin, let's just run through some of the stories this week. We've had an interesting article in the Daily Express about Erdogan wanting to smash up a secret NATO army over its alleged role in the coup in Turkey. Now he's referring to Operation Gladio, which was a code name for a clandestine NATO operation in Italy during the Cold War, which we talk about quite regularly on this programme.
Yeah, well, the reason I drew your attention to this is because the Daily Express are reporting on what's going on. I mean, I wouldn't normally read the Daily Express, but they have actually raised this whole question of Gladio in Turkey, because Erdogan's raised it. And, of course, in Turkey, it was actually known as the Ergonican Networks. But in actual fact, even in mainstream press now, we've got the people beginning to realise that NATO is, in fact, a terrorist organisation that engages in military coups, it engages in false flag terrorism, and now you've got the president, the elected president of Turkey, no friend of freedom, really, but at the same time, it's all coming out in the wash, isn't it? That's the reality of what NATO's about, military coups in Turkey.
Well, actually, it's much simpler. And it was Trump gave it away. About 10 days ago, he said he was going to make people like the United Kingdom, France, and Germany, and so on, pay more for their American weapons. We are just planning to buy some planes from the United States, not from British Aerospace, and they're going to cost £85 million each.
Yeah, and they don't work.
And they don't work.
Yeah. Absolute rubbish plane.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of money being made behind the scenes by NATO, but they don't just make money. They also carry out coups and carry out terrorist attacks.
Okay, also, I got an email from Max over in Dresden. Thanks, Max, who I met over at the Bilderberg conference there. He says from the 7th to the 12th of August, there are 235 activists from Germany heading over from Berlin towards Moscow. The tour will set a clear statement for Western friendship with Russia and against the military actions of the NATO countries on the Russian border. He's going to be following that little tour, Martin, and we hope to have him on the show
in the future weeks. Just a very quick comment there. The agitation against Russia is not being conducted by... Go to the NATO countries. Angela Merkel is really down. The agitation against Russia is being conducted by the American military. It's narrower even than NATO. It's a bunch of clowns like Clapper.
Well, we've got the ban of quite a lot of the Russian Olympics athletes, etc. And yet, Lizzie Armistead has missed three drugs tests, a British athlete, and she's still able to compete. So it doesn't seem like they've got a very level playing field there. Also, Martin, this week, report on RT, Russia Today, official documents on Britain's relationship with Israel, including papers on military and nuclear collaboration in the 1970s, have disappeared from Kew at the National Archives. More than 400 records have gone missing, including a 1947 letter from Winston Churchill and a Home Office document on the 1910 suffragette disturbances. Now we know about this Operation Unthinkable, where Churchill wanted to nuke Moscow.
Yes, but I mean, the obviously what we're talking about here is Israel's nuclear weapons, which of course they deny having, even though everybody knows they've got them. When are we going to do, you know, what point is anybody going to do anything about that? That is the real threat in the Middle East, is that the Israelis are going to nuke one of their neighbours who haven't got nuclear weapons. If you were the Iranian general staff, you could see the argument for having something similar yourself, couldn't you?
Also, top UK diplomats nominated to be the new EU commissioner. That is, Britain's ambassador to France is going to be the UK's next and potentially last, Sir Julian King. He's been put forward by David Cameron, and he'll be doing... anti-terror and security.
Yes, well, I mean, Brexit's probably caused some problems for the NATO leadership. But what, interestingly enough, with Britain out of the European Union, if we can get out, if that's what people really want, I think the French and the Germans, Steinmeier in particular, the foreign minister, want to lift sanctions on Russia very, very rapidly. And with the British out of the question, that might actually happen.
I think we should probably leave Susan Lindauer till next week, folks, because I've got. I want to get Kevin's thoughts on this one. The first message. This actually is in July, a story I missed. The first person's died from a self in a crash of a self-driving car, and that he was actually watching Harry Potter as he crashed, apparently. Joshua Brown, 40, was behind the wheel of self-driving Tesla Model S car. He was killed when the vehicle collided with a trailer truck in Florida in May. Real problem here for a lot of people is insurance. Insurance companies are going nuts about this because they're not really quite sure who's to blame for a crash of a self-driving car.
The owner of the car.
Well, he's dead. He was in the car.
Yes, his estate insurance. But false drama like that. If you own a car, whether you use, you know, software to drive it or yourself, you're responsible if you run into something.
And just as this is announced, we hear that there's a first test fleet of driverless cars to be launched in Singapore. BMW has been joining forces with Israel's Mobileye to create a self-driving car for Singapore. I just see this as a technology too far. It just seems to me we've got so many people dying on our roads as it is. The idea that you've got some kind of remote-controlled hackable car, Martin, driving around as well, makes it even more dangerous. But, and yet, this is apparently some wonderful new technology.
I think the word you use there, hackable, is very important. Michael Hastings, who was assassinated, we believe, in the United States, it was done by hacking into
He was a journalist looking into the CIA.
That's right, and then his car's just suddenly accelerated into a wall at 90 miles an hour because somebody was able to hack into the computer running the car. Very worrying.
So, Kevin, what do you think there is a future for driverless vehicles and fleets?
Yeah, a long way
off. They're
even
talking about buses, driverless buses now.
Try 50 years. It's the neither the sensors nor the software are adequate to the job.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Mohamed Makawi's out in the Sudan for a few weeks. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's Conservative Councillor for Stockwood, Steve Jones. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Carhill. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon every Tuesday, where you can hear Stonehenge. This and Breaking the Spell of Money with Tim Herford from the Transpersonals and me having a chat on there. Thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and its links and archives. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.